Hey everybody, we hope you're enjoying some episodes from the Classical Classroom Vault right now. We are currently working on a new season of exciting shows, and we'll be back with new episodes very, very soon. Meanwhile, if you are just dying for some fresh new Classical Classroom content, you can now follow us on Tumblr and Twitter. Just look up Classical Classroom on either one of those, and you should be able to find us. If you want to follow me directly, I'm CC Daisha. On Twitter. That's my handle. All right, sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode from the Classical Classroom Vault. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, the thing is, I want to learn. And as it turns out, I work with people who know a lot about classical music. Every week on this show, one of my coworkers will give me a homework assignment, a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and today my teacher is going to be the inimitable Amy Bishop, who is the host of Classical 91.7's Saturday Morning Music, but more importantly, is an expert contra dancer, and, as it turns out, has a cat who has the same name as mine.
No.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. Gus.
Yeah.
The best.
I know.
The best cat name ever.
I think
ever.
We're kindred spirits.
I think,
you know.
I think so. I can moonwalk. You can contra dance.
A lot of parallels.
So Amy, what are you going to be teaching me about today?
Well, I chose the subject of tone poems, or some people call them symphonic poems. There's a couple of minor differences in the definitions, but the terms are basically interchangeable. I love tone poems. Just the sound tone poem, it just sounds so charming.
Yeah.
It's all about telling a story or painting a picture. And I love music that sort of evokes these images and tells stories of some kind. Or there's a composer who says, I have this vision in my head, and I want to make that into a sort of a musical painting. And some of my favorite pieces are tone poems.
Let me ask you a potentially really stupid question. But like when... Okay, so these three pieces that we're looking into today, they're all tone poems. But does a composer sit down and say to him or herself, I am going to write a tone poem, and then there are like, you know, these sort of prescribed, you know, rules that you follow to make a piece that's a tone poem? Or is it kind of like, is it a bit looser than that,
where it just sort of happens?
Because I mean, if you're gonna write a haiku, you're like, I'm gonna write a haiku.
I think it's a little of both. I think that the term didn't even come about till like the mid 19th century, and the pioneer was Franz Liszt. I don't think he was saying, I'm gonna write a tone poem. I think maybe he wrote these pieces and then said, I don't know if it was him that coined the term or if he was like, hey, these are, I'm going to call them tone poems. And then people sort of followed suit after that.
Yeah.
But they're usually, you know, one single movement. It almost makes me think that maybe the composer is sitting down to say, I'm going to write a tone poem, because it's always self-contained in one movement.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So it is like, it's not something that is spanning a bunch of different movements.
Not
it,
really.
It is a movement.
Right.
And the three pieces that you had me listen to before we met today, I don't know if you want to introduce them, because
sure.
I will butcher the names. Yeah. So what
okay.
do you say?
I chose, well, my favorite piece was Smetana's The Moldau.
Oh,
and
so good.
Yeah, it was great. And that's a tone poem. And he wrote six that make up a larger work called Mavlast, or My Country, or My Homeland.
Uh-huh.
And they're all tone poems, but The Moldau is definitely the most popular of mm-hmm. all six of those. And again, it's sort of telling a story, evoking images of his native Bohemia with mm-hmm. the river that runs through, well, what's now the Czech Republic, and through Prague.
Yeah. Yeah. That piece, with most of the pieces that people have given me as homework assignments for the classical classroom, I honestly haven't really liked many of them until after our conversations, you know?
Like, yeah.
It's kind of like reading a classic book, you know, mm-hmm. where, or, you know, like reading Dostoevsky or something like that, and you don't really understand what you're reading, what you're, you know, until somebody tells you,
this symbolism.
This is the context, mm-hmm. this is what's happening. And so, but with the Smetana, I just instantly loved it. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is, and I think it must be because my people personally are rumored to be from Bohemia.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So are mine.
What?
Yes.
No.
Yes. That's why it's one of my favorite pieces, because my grandmother on my dad's side was full-blooded Czech, like from the old country.
Yeah.
And so I've always sort of had this, you know, connection with Bohemian and Czech composers. Uh-huh. And I've been to Prague a couple of times. And so after the piece was a favorite of mine, you know, before I went to Prague, but once I went there and I saw the scenery and I saw the river going through the city, the music just had a whole new meaning for me.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it was really just totally, you know, turned the music on and instantly loved it. I love that refrain.
Well, here's the really fascinating part about Smetana. You know, usually when people talk about deaf composers, the first name that comes to mind is Beethoven. Mm-hmm. Smetana also lost his hearing during his lifetime as a composer, and he wrote Ma Vlast, all six of these tone poems, after he was stone deaf.
Oh my God.
yeah. So the Moldau is the German word for the river, but in Czech it's Vltava. And I'll say that because I'm going to quote what Smetana said in his own words to describe the piece. So when I refer to the Vltava, it's the Moldau.
Okay.
So he wrote that the composition describes the course of the Vltava, starting from the two small springs, the cold and warm Vltava, to the unification of both streams into a single current. The course of the Vltava through woods and meadows, through landscapes where a farmer's wedding is celebrated, the round dance of the mermaids in the night's moonshine. On the nearby rocks loom proud castles, palaces, and ruins aloft. The Vltava swirls into St. John's Rapids, then it widens and flows toward Prague, past the Vyšehrad, and then majestically vanishes into the distance, ending at the Elbe. The Elbe is another river that goes through there. So I wanted to set up that portrait so that you can imagine the course of the river as it winds through the Bohemian woods and meadows.
Well, when did he write this piece?
In 1874.
Okay. That gives me a little bit of context.
An idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
So should we listen?
Yeah, let's give it a listen.
So this is sort of the introduction where he's talking about the two small springs mm-hmm. who are meeting up together to create one river. And there it is, the unification of both streams into a single current that he was talking about.
I love that.
I read this book one time by a music historian named Bill Parker, and he was describing the work. He said, if ever there was music with sweep to it, this would be it.
Yeah.
It's sweeping and swirling.
Definitely. I mean, the way that he's able to musically capture the course of a river mm-hmm. with all of these, this music just has all of these moving parts.
Right.
It's so cool.
That's why it's a tone poem.
Is it?
It's musically poetic. That's the way I describe it.
Yeah. But it does so without being cheesy. you know? Like, there's something sort of genuine about this music.
Right.
I can't put my finger on it.
Well, I think that, you know, he's writing music about his homeland, mm-hmm. and he is passionate. He was one of the nationalist composers, one of the Czech nationalists,
yeah.
which nationalism was a big thing at that time, and sort of like, you know, creating patriotism mm-hmm. among the people. And so when you're passionate about something, it's easy to show it.
Yeah, I guess it comes across.
Mm-hmm.
So where are we? Where are we? At what point in the river?
We are winding through the woods and meadows
okay.
at the moment, and we are about to come upon the farmer's wedding. So if you can imagine a traditional Czech wedding and people in their bohemian clothes,
uh-huh.
outdoors, lots of like ribbons and flowers and things.
Mm-hmm.
It's very festive, folksy kind of sound to it. Czech folk music.
Yeah. This sounds nothing like the polka my grandpa made me listen to.
You know, I bet you'd be surprised. In a kind of does.
It's got it's got some bounciness
yeah.
to it.
Right.
But not the oompa.
Right. Well, yeah.
Yeah. The oompa is key. So where are we moving on to now?
Now I believe we're moving on to the round dance of the mermaids in the night's moonshine. Think of these women of the waters. These majestic mermaid-like creatures in the moonlight.
Clearly he's being figurative. They don't have, you know, mermaids
no.
in the
oh,
Czech Republic.
Yeah,
talking about?
I should have mentioned that, yes, he is depicting the countryside here, but also the history and the legends of Bohemia
oh.
all within this work. So,
cool.
So it's sort of a combination of real and imagined.
Or fantasy, mm-hmm. sort of,
some of the old legends, some of the old Czech legends.
Yeah. Folk tales. Do you know anything about the legend that's behind the mermaid thing?
Well, sort of. There are several legends about like women in waters across Europe that mm-hmm. are all basically the same. Like Fair Melusina by Mendelssohn is another one of those pieces that is inspired by this beautiful woman who lives in the waters and.
Yeah.
I think sort of like sirens in a way, the
okay.
same general idea. It's like every culture has its own version.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were they like in the Odyssey, the sirens are they seem to be lovely, but actually it's just a trap, and the sailors approach them and then they die on the rocks.
Right.
You know, is it like that?
Or pretty to look at.
Yeah.
I
I think that for the most part, yeah, they are, you know, these beautiful women who attract men, but then yeah. There's not a good outcome.
They lure unsuspecting drunk men into the waters and then they die.
But I don't know if I really don't think that's the case for the mermaids, the Czech mermaids okay. in this music.
They're not.
I think
killers.
They're nice.
Nice sirens.
They're the kind of girls you can bring home to mom.
Don't put that in there.
Ooh, are we getting to the falls now?
Yeah, this is swirling into the St. John's Rapids, where it widens and flows toward Prague. There's this castle. If you've seen pictures of Prague, there's this huge castle that is high up on a hill that overlooks the city. It's called Vyšehrad. And so when you're moving into Prague, that's what you're seeing on the horizon, sort of, because it's the tallest thing there. So that is coming into view once you get through these rapids.
Okay. This is my favorite part. So we've moved past the rapids, and where are we going now?
We're getting into Prague.
Okay.
And you can see that castle up on the hill.
Yeah.
As you move in.
Sounds very majestic.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like water flowing, but it does.
It does, yeah. It's those strings.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going back to the streams.
Right. The castle has vanished off in the distance, and we have just connected with the other river that's called the Elbe.
The Elbe. I don't know why that part makes me laugh every time I listen to this. It reminds me, for some reason, of like Looney Tunes. It was kind of like he just didn't know what to do at the end of this beautiful piece. It's like, it's so amazing. It's so majestic. And then he's like, well, I don't know where to go now. How about dum, dum?
Well, you know, I know of some of the things that were in Smetana's mind when he wrote that, but I don't know about that. I can't confirm.
Well, so, okay, so that's an example of a tome poem, or what was the other word for it?
A symphonic poem.
Okay. Tome poem's way better, you're right.
I like tone poem, yeah. I mean, like I said, there are a few differences in the definition, but these days, for the sake of simplicity, usually they're interchangeable.
Yeah. Yeah, so you have a couple of other pieces.
I do.
That are examples of a tome poem as well. What's the next piece?
The next piece is Richard Strauss's Death and Transfiguration, and it's a pretty like dark subject.
Yeah.
And it's basically about a man who's coming to terms with his death on his deathbed. And Strauss was 25 when he wrote this.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So you know, you're thinking like, gosh, you're a very deep 25-year-old. You're already thinking about
your mortality. What
your last years are going to be like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're just in the, you know, first 25 years of your life. So what I'm going to do is just read what sort of story he was trying to tell in this piece. Because it is a picture, but in this case, I think it's more of a story. I mean, this maybe it's a little of both, but by telling the story, maybe you're seeing the picture. But okay, in Richard Strauss's words for Death and Transfiguration, he said, "The sick man lies in bed asleep, breathing heavily and irregularly. Agreeable dreams charm a smile on his features in spite of his suffering. His sleep becomes lighter. He wakens. Once again, he is racked by terrible pain. His limbs shake with fever. As the attack draws to a close and the pain subsides, he reflects on his past life. His childhood passes before him. His youth with its striving, its passions. And then, while the pain resumes, the fruit of his path through life appears to him. The idea, the ideal, which he has tried to realize, to represent in his art, but which he has been unable to perfect because it was not for any human being to perfect it. The hour of death approaches. The soul leaves the body in order to find perfected in the most glorious form in the eternal cosmos that which he could not fulfill here on earth."
Damn, Richard. That is some intense, intense
stuff.
Isn't
that deep for a 25-year-old? Tell me about it. So yeah, these are these sweet reminiscences of childhood. If you can imagine a man in his dimly lit room.
Yeah.
Do you hear that? It's supposed to be, some people say it's a clock ticking, and others say it's a heartbeat.
It's like, it sounds to me sort of like he's on the event horizon of death, you know, like the area on a black hole where you can't escape anymore. You're on the way, but you're not quite in the black hole yet.
And in just a minute, the mood will lighten a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that's whenever he starts having these fond memories of childhood. Mm-hmm. Not quite yet, though. He's still moaning and sighing right now.
I was really struck when you were reading what Strauss had to say about this piece, by how many movements, I guess, he believed that there were in the death process. Like, it's a very intricate imagining of, I mean, I'm not sure if at that point in his life he had watched anyone die or anything, you know,
that's a good point.
Was drawing on something.
Yeah, no,
because it sounds like it's informed, like he's I can't imagine a 25-year-old man just sort of, you know, pulling that out of his baton.
Hi, good thing I've caught you there, huh?
Whoa.
Right?
So that literally blew me back.
It's supposed to be this sudden attack of pain all of a sudden. Like, he's having these sweet dreams of childhood, and then all of a sudden, bam, here comes some more pain, and he's writhing and uncomfortable again. But then that'll eventually pass. And then he goes into this long process of again thinking back to his entire life, and he thinks about, you know, this passionate love affair and his childhood memories. That takes up the majority of the piece.
This part of the music, not to derail you, but this part of the music really reminded me of, for some reason, the music from, of all things, Rebel Without a Cause.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Oh, this man, I think his name was Leonard Rosen, was the composer who wrote the soundtrack for that movie. And, you know, Rebel Without a Cause is very, you know, it's very melodramatic, and so is the music that goes along with it. And this reminds me so much of, like, the fight scene. There's, like, a knife fight scene.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. I could see that. Yeah. It's funny, like, how many different contrasts there are, because here it's just, obviously, it's a man who's in serious pain. But then toward the end, you know, it's called Death and Transfiguration.
Yeah.
So at the end, it's this very just beautiful sort of ethereal ending that Strauss was trying to evoke with the soul leaving the body and going to the afterworld.
What's kind of interesting to me is that he sees Death and Transfiguration as one thing. You know, you were saying that a tome poem is something that's self-contained, and so...
Right,
you know,
that's a good point.
Yeah, like, death and what happens after the point of dying. Like, there's no point in this music where I can tell where there's a marker that death has happened.
Right.
There's just a sort of passing into death, and then there's the being transfigured.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Sort of a different way to look at the end of a life.
The other really neat thing about this is that when he was on his deathbed, when Richard Strauss was on his deathbed many years later, he told his daughter-in-law, "It's amazing, Alice. It's just as I wrote it in Death and Transfiguration."
What? Holy moly. Wow, that was... So that's it. It just sort of... There's no Looney Tunes ending to this one.
No,
it actually
there's no
is
boom,
over.
Okay. Boom. No, no. So, yeah, Death and Transfiguration by Richard Strauss. Should we go ahead and move on to our final one?
Yes, let's move on to Gershwin's An American in Paris.
Right, so tone poems, like I said, sort of came into prominence in the mid-19th century, and then they kind of went on a decline by the early 20th century, like around the 1920s, and the popularity just declined. I don't know why, but I guess because there were other big things going on in music at that time. And but one of the later tone poems was by George Gershwin, and it was semi-autobiographical, or actually it was autobiographical, and it's called An American in Paris, and the title kind of explains it all. He was an American in Paris in the 1920s, which was such a cool time to be in Paris, because you had all of these creative people who were there, like Hemingway was there, and Picasso was there, and it was just this great scene.
Just like the movie. You know the latest Woody Allen movie? Midnight in Paris, that time period, the you know, you got your Hemingway, you've got your Gertrude Stein, you've got your other people who are living large.
A lot of people who weren't French who were in France.
Yeah.
It was such a cool time to be there. Gershwin was there as well. And this was sort of like a souvenir. He was inspired by the sights and the sounds of Paris that he wanted to write something to, I guess, in a way to remember it.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I feel like the best way to describe the piece of music is to use the words from the composer. And that, you know, that makes it simpler or easier for me. Mm-hmm. So I do have how Gershwin described An American in Paris. He said, "My purpose here is to portray the impression of an American visitor in Paris as he strolls about the city and listens to various street noises and absorbs the French atmosphere. When the tone poem moves into the blues, our American friend has succumbed to a spasm of homesickness. But nostalgia is not a fatal disease. The American visitor, once again, is an alert spectator of Parisian life, and the street noises and French atmosphere are triumphant. And you can hear this sort of, like, happy, jaunting American strolling. It's supposed to sound like, you know, Gershwin is walking along and then taking in all of the sights and sounds of the capital. What's that? What's that?
I'm so happy to be in Paris.
Bonjour.
Okay, so do you hear what sounds like car horns?
Yeah.
So he was trying to be, like, so true to the sounds of Paris that Gershwin actually went and got Parisian taxi horns and brought them back for the performance when he came back to the United States, because he wanted to sound as real as possible. So he had all these taxi horns that he brought back, and they used the taxi horns. He put it in the score.
Insert taxi horn here. Is that what the sheet music says?
Yeah. You know, there are these French taxis whizzing by, and people on bicycles, and probably, you know, probably mimes or something.
Definitely there are mimes. You can hear them.
Girls with a bicycle and a basket with a baguette in it, mm-hmm. some fresh flowers.
Yeah, baguettes everywhere. Yeah. I've been to Paris, and there were indeed baguettes everywhere. I saw no mimes, though.
No?
No.
So somewhere along the way, though, this American in Paris, he's all excited about what he's seeing, but then suddenly he gets a little bout of homesickness. And you can hear that whenever Gershwin sort of goes into this, like, low-down, bluesy kind of sound. That's whenever he sort of, you know, gets a little twinge of mm-hmm. homesickness, but then he gets over it in a little bit.
Yeah.
So the mood changes a little bit.
Yeah, kind of brings it down.
Yeah. Aw, shucks. I kind of miss home.
I miss Mom.
I miss Mom's cooking.
So, do you think he went to blues because the blues were coming out of the U.S.
Yeah.
At that time?
Yeah, you know, it's America's music, and yeah. I think it sort of took him back a little bit and made him think, yeah... home. But, in Gershwin's word, like I said, nostalgia is not a fatal disease. The American visitor, once again, is an alert spectator of Parisian life. So, this is obviously the part where he's no longer homesick.
Yeah, clearly, he's gotten over it.
But wait a minute! I'm in Paris!
Right. There are baguettes and mimes.
And beautiful French women.
That's probably what happened. Mm-hmm. His head was turning.
I know.
Quickly forgot.
Yeah. Jazz hands. And as Gershwin awesome. Said, the street noises and French atmosphere are triumphant. So I tried to, you know, end things on a lighter note because we, you know, I didn't want to end with just death and transfiguration.
Thank
well, that's
you.
All, folks. Boom, boom. So that
was... Yeah, thanks for not ending with
I didn't want to end with a downer. So, yeah. And plus, I wanted to sort of give an idea of the diversity mm-hmm. that is among the tone poems, even though they span less than... a century, really. So, like, from the 1840s to the 1920s, more or less, that there's such a range of subjects and such a range of sounds among the three that I chose. And there are, like I said, so many others.
Yeah, I think these three did a really good job of showing the kind of a whole picture of mm-hmm. what a tone poem can be. Like, it could be, you know, showing your majestic homeland. It can be showing, you know, something... about a moment in life or you know, about an experience traveling. I mean, it can be like a poem mm-hmm. about anything yeah. that you like. And
like I said, I love music that tells a story or yeah. that is like the composer painting mm-hmm. a picture, but instead of using a paintbrush, he's using yeah. music.
Well, I like how you said it at first. That's kind of how I thought about all three of these pieces was without words, you're going along on this journey with the composer and you're just sort of propelled through it from beginning to end and like, experiencing almost a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for showing this to me.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah, it's
my
pleasure.
And I got to learn things about you, too. I got to learn that you have a cat that has the same name as me.
Yeah.
We both have Czech ancestry.
And I can break dance and you can
contra dance.
So I feel like this has been a learning experience all around.
I agree. I agree. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, this has been great. Everybody, thanks for listening and we'll catch you next time.